Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York voters head to the polls Tuesday for primary elections across the state. The only statewide race on the ballot is the Democratic primary for state controller. Coming up, we'll hear from Drew Warshaw, one of the two challengers to incumbent Tom DiNapoli, about why he says it's time for new leadership overseeing New York's finances and pension fund. This Pride Month, we're exploring a little-known piece of LGBTQ history from rural New York. A communal settlement called Lavender Hill became a hub for liberation, activism, and new ways of living in the 70s. Plus, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. And Grammy winner Melissa Etheridge joins us to talk about why radio remains at the heart of her latest tour. That's ahead after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Vice President Vance has concluded the first round of high-level talks with Iranian officials in Switzerland. The mediators are Pakistan and Qatar. Officials from these two countries say technical teams from Iran and the U.S. will go on talking about the details of the preliminary agreement. NPR's Aya Batrawi has more.
Mediators say technical talks on Iran's nuclear program and U.S. sanctions are continuing through the week in Switzerland in order to reach a final deal within 60 days. They say the U.S. and Iran also agreed to create a, quote, deconfliction cell to ensure a ceasefire in Lebanon holds. This comes after high-level talks concluded in Switzerland in what mediators say was a, quote, positive and constructive atmosphere. Those talks almost didn't happen. Iran's delegation refused to meet Vance due to Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon. Iran and said it was closing the Strait of Hormuz, and President Trump threatened the U.S. could resume attacks on Iran. But by Sunday, the two sides were sitting down for talks, and there were no new attacks between Iran-backed Hezbollah and Israel in Lebanon. Aya Batrawi, NPR News, Dubai.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is resigning as head of the Labour Party, effectively stepping down as prime minister as well. He says he'll stay on as caretaker prime minister until a new leader is chosen. That could possibly be Andy Burnham, the former mayor of Greater Manchester. Burnham just won election to the UK Parliament last week and said today he intends to run for Labour Party leader. If he wins, he'll also become Britain's new prime minister. NPR's Lauren Freyer says his policies are not that substantially different from Starmer's.
He's seen more as sort of folksy, able to connect with voters in a way that Starmer did not. Perhaps slightly to the left of Starmer, more likely to sort of robustly defend a welfare state. But he will face the same headwinds, you know, rising global energy prices, strained public finances. So in a way, this is a change in personality at the top rather than policy.
NPR's Lauren Freyer reporting. Stocks opened higher this morning on a day when investors are remembering the late Alan Greenspan. NPR's Scott Horsley reports he died this morning at his home in Washington at the age of 100.
The Federal Reserve said in a statement today that Greenspan's nearly two decades at the helm of the central bank was marked by periods of significant economic expansion as well as periods of considerable stress. Former colleagues say Greenspan brought rigorous analytical discipline to monetary policymaking and helped establish the credibility that remains one of the Federal Reserve's most important assets. Greenspan was an acolyte of the libertarian Ayn Rand and a reluctant regulator who believed bankers' self-interest would prevent them from excessive risk. He acknowledged the shortcomings of that hands-off approach only after risky behavior produced the Great Financial Crisis 2 years after he left the Fed in 2006. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. Elon Musk's company SpaceX could soon end up in your retirement funds. The company's stock is up more than 23% since going public earlier this month. Some investment firms have changed their rules to let big tech companies join popular stock market index lists early. NPR Stephen Bisaha explains.
Normally, a new public company like SpaceX has to wait months or years to get into popular indexes, basically a list of differently weighted stocks that retirement accounts often invest in. But a couple of groups that run these lists change their rules to add large IPOs much faster. SpaceX is going to be added to the NASDAQ 100 in a few weeks. That's left some personal investors concerned firms are changing rules to favor large companies. Both AI companies Anthropic and OpenAI are expected to have their own IPOs this year. Not all indexes change their rules. SpaceX still has to wait at least a year to join the S&P 500 and must prove profitability. Stephen Bisaha, NPR News.
The Los Angeles Unified School District says its superintendent, Alberto Carvalho, has resigned. He's been on administrative leave for 4 months since the FBI searched his home and office. The LA searches are reported to be linked to a company that created a chatbot for the city's students, but the AI project only lasted a short time. In March, Carvalho released a statement declaring his innocence. The Iron Fire in central Utah continues to burn. It has scorched more than 30 square miles, and none of it is contained. There are concerns about the nearby town of Eureka. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. New York's primary is tomorrow. The only statewide race on the ballot is for state controller. The controller oversees the state payroll, leads audits of government spending, and manages New York's nearly $300 billion pension fund. Incumbent Tom DiNapoli is seeking a fifth full term. He faces two challengers in the primary this year, Raj Goyal and Drew Warshaw. Goyal, a former Kansas state legislator who moved to New York in 2010 to start a tech company, is running on proposals to divest the state pension fund from fossil fuels and Israel bonds. Warshaw is a first-time candidate, though he has previously held roles in government. He's made the case that while DiNapoli has the backing of the Democratic Party, voters should think about whether someone else could be better. He spoke with our own Patricio Rubio about his candidacy.
I'm a lifelong New Yorker. I live in New York City with my two young boys and my wife, and really spent my career fighting for people who didn't have power or necessarily didn't have money. I started my career fighting for campaign finance reform, for public financing of campaigns to get big money out of politics, then fought for immigrant rights to get a basic driver's license for immigrants who couldn't get that basic documentation to live their life here. At a moment, unfortunately, when my opponents were fighting against that very thing, and then was blessed to help rebuild the World Trade Center after 9/11 as the chief of staff at the Port Authority, built a renewable energy company and built solar and wind power infrastructure all across the United States to help take on these utility monopolies that are crushing ratepayers and to lower electricity rates with clean energy. And most recently, I was lucky enough to run the largest affordable housing nonprofit in the country. And it was really there where it became very clear that we needed two things more than any other, and that was money and power. And I looked over and there was one person up in Albany who was running for a sixth term. And I thought five was enough. And the state controller has an enormous amount of power and an enormous amount of money that could be used for the working New Yorkers without those things. And I thought it was time for a change.
That actually leads to my second question that you sort of answered already. What made you decide to run for New York State Comptroller?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a perennial runner for office. I've never run for office before. I just kind of walked you through what I have done for my career. But I just got to a point where every year I was fighting the affordable housing crisis, the housing crisis got worse. And my two young boys go to our local public school here. One out of every seven New York City public school students, they don't go home at night because they don't have one. They're homeless. And one person is sitting up in Albany in charge of a $300 billion investment fund. You know, take politics away for a minute. He is the third largest investor in the United States of America. And he has outsourced our power and our money. And I say this is ours because it's the property taxpayers of New York who fund the public pension fund. And he has outsourced our money and our power to hundreds of Wall Street investment managers who have lit our money on fire, who have literally underperformed the market by 39%. And none of that money is going into homes that New Yorkers can afford. And in fact, we looked at it and 95% of all of the money that we put into that pension fund that goes into real estate, it leaves the state of New York. It goes into luxury condos in Fort Lauderdale and in California. And I think our money from our local communities ought to be reinvested in our local communities. So the cavalry was not coming. The cavalry is us. I truly believe that. And we need to go in this moment into positions of power and money and get that power and get that money. Use it for the New Yorkers who don't have those things.
A lot of people hear the word comptroller and may not fully understand the job. How would you explain the office?
Sure. You know, I already mentioned it's the third largest investor in the United States. So one person controls the investment decisions of $300 billion of our taxpayer-funded pension funds. So that's one major lever of power. A second major lever of power is he is the chief auditor of anything that touches state spending, which if used creatively and used with imagination, can be anything, can be everything. You know, one thing that I have proposed doing that he has refused to do is audit the local law enforcement agencies that our local taxes are funding, and yet right now are colluding with Donald Trump's private militia, with ICE, to terrorize our neighbors. And he has the unilateral power to deploy the 3,000 auditors who work for him across those law enforcement agencies to ensure that our tax dollars are not being used to terrorize other New Yorkers, but are being used properly. And he refuses to do that. So that is yet another major lever of power. And that is my problem, is that he is in a moment where we have never needed more power and we have never needed more money in this affordability crisis. He can use those things for New Yorkers. One other, you know, proposal that I have is to audit these utility monopolies that are crushing ratepayers. You know, whether it is Central Hudson Gas and Electric or Rockland County Gas and Electric, Con Edison down in New York City, National Grid, NYSEG, you know them all. These monopolies are only as good as their regulator, and their regulator has never been audited, and they're sitting up in Albany. And I built renewable energy infrastructure for a living. I have experience in doing this, in fighting these utility monopolies. We could actually lower electricity rates if we had a state controller who was focused on this problem. But he has said that is not his job. And I think that is precisely his job.
You mentioned affordability. You gave the example of your own children there. What does affordability mean to you, and how can a comptroller address that?
Yeah, I mean, affordability to me means that that a family is allowed to think about something other than where they're going to get their next paycheck and how they're going to afford their own home and pay for groceries and gas that continues to increase faster than their wages. And so to me, affordability is just to live a life without that level of stress and insecurity. And again, here, this is where the state controller actually has a part to play. One, to take pressure off of your property taxes, because right now those property taxes are subsidizing his failed investment strategy with this public pension fund. He has made these Wall Street bankers who he pays $1 billion of taxpayer-funded fees to, he's made them millionaires off of the backs of working taxpayers and public school teachers and firefighters. So that's one direct way. And we're going to cut out the Wall Street middlemen. We're literally going to fire those bankers who are sucking value and not adding value. And we're going to save New Yorkers their property taxes. Another thing that we're going to do is we're going to start the largest affordable housing fund in the United States of America. I'm going to take the experience of running this affordable housing nonprofit. We're going to bring that into this comptroller's office. And we're literally the only candidate, shockingly, with a plan, an actual concrete, actionable plan to address this housing crisis that is crushing New Yorkers. And this is not just a New York City crisis. I want to be clear about that. This is an everywhere crisis. This is a problem in the suburban areas of New York, in obviously the cities, but also the rural areas of New York, where people cannot afford to live where they work or they live where they retire. And the state comptroller's office, instead of investing in hedge funds, could invest in homes that New Yorkers can afford.
You mentioned, you know, rural communities. You know, if you could just expand on that a little bit, but how would you help outside of New York City?
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned property taxes. I mentioned electricity rates, you know, but just to drive that home, you know, people are being crushed right now by electricity rates that are doubling and even in some cases tripling. And one of the things that, you know, because I have experience fighting these utility monopolies, I understand they are guaranteed a profit margin by the state. They're guaranteed a practically 10%, it's 9.5% rate of return on every single dollar they spend. And that profit margin should not be nearly that high for these monopolies that have a captive customer base where you as a ratepayer do not have a choice to buy your electricity from anyone other than this monopoly. And there's no reason why their guaranteed profit margin should be that high. The state controller can actually lower it. We have a proposal that we have for the first time ever. Someone has proposed to actually reduce their profit margin. And we could do that both by using the two major levers of power, the audit power to audit their regulator, and their investment power to be able to invest at a lower rate of return than that 9.5% and literally dollar for dollar lower electricity rates in the process. We believe we could save New Yorkers $300 off of their electricity bill and still earn a higher rate of return for the pension fund, higher than their 5.9% target rate that Mr. DiNapoli has set. So we believe we can actually address this crisis of rising electricity rates all over New York and still earn a higher rate of return for the pension fund.
You mentioned, you know, sort of the concerns about Wall Street fees and outside money managers. What do you think is wrong with the current system we have now?
Yeah, so let's be like very clear about this because unfortunately, most New Yorkers, you know, have never heard of the state controller's office or really how the pension fund system really works. So just to be clear, the way this $300 billion pension fund is invested today and for the last 20 years under this five-term incumbent is that he gives it away to literally 664 different Wall Street investment managers. We counted. And he pays them $1 billion for the service, the supposed service of beating the market index net of those fees. And incredibly, no one in the financial capital of the world until we came along ever quantified the performance of the third largest investor in the United States and all of the bankers that he has made millionaires. And it turns out over the last 20 years, he and they have actually underperformed his own benchmarks by 39%. He's cost taxpayers an additional $59 billion of higher taxes to subsidize and bail out his failed strategy and his underperforming bankers. Now, why have taxes gone up to bail them out? It's because the pension fund must be fully funded by law. So if he's not a good investor, and we know he hasn't been over the last 20 years, then it's the taxpayers of New York who have to make that up, who have to fill that gap. And if you and I didn't do our job for 20 years, we'd be fired. We would not be made millionaires off of the backs of working New Yorkers. And unfortunately, that is exactly what Mr. DiNapoli has done for the last 20 years. And that's why I believe five terms is enough and we've got to have a change.
If you're elected, what would be one of the first things you will want to change in the comptroller's office?
Sure. So three very specific things. I would cut out these Wall Street middlemen who are literally sucking working New Yorkers' money right out of their pocketbooks. And that would save New Yorkers $1 billion of taxes in fees that we don't need to pay these people. That's one. Two, I would get ICE out of New York by deploying these auditors where they should be in these law enforcement agencies that are informally and formally colluding with Donald Trump's private militia. And three, I would divest from the things that are killing our people, our planet, and our pension fund. The fossil fuel companies that Mr. DiNapoli refuses to divest from, despite the fact that they're not only killing the planet, they literally have lost the pension fund money. Again, if you go to our website, drewwarshaw.com, we put a whole report out that showed that they've lost the pension fund, $15 billion. I would get our money out of these foreign governments 6,000 miles away where New York tax dollars are literally funding war machines instead of homes that New Yorkers can afford right here in New York. And I would divest from Palantir, literally the IT backbone of ICE that Mr. DiNapoli has invested $500 million into. So we will start the largest affordable housing fund in the country. That's what we will invest in our communities in New York. And we will divest from the things that are killing our people, our planet, and our pension fund.
Why do you believe this office matters in people's everyday lives?
Yeah, you know, I think what I've tried to make the case is this office has enormous amounts of power. It's just not being used. You know, someone said to me the other day, well, it sounds like you want to expand the powers of the comptroller's office. And I said, no, I don't want to expand it. I just want to use it. And that's what we need to do in this moment. If we are not using power and money for those working New Yorkers who need those things, then you got to step aside. And if after 20 years you have not done that, you don't deserve a sixth term. You know, and he has never been challenged before, ever. This is the very first time. And for the first time in 20 years, we have a choice and a chance to seize one of the most powerful offices, not just in New York, but in the country, because this is an office that directly affects your pocketbooks and can fight the Trump administration, take on utility monopolies. All of that flows through the state comptroller's office. And he said to the New York Times that his proudest accomplishment in 20 years, literally his greatest accomplishment, these were his words, is, quote, "I have not had to resign." That is the bar that he has set. That is way too low a bar in this moment. We've got to raise that bar. And I hope my proudest accomplishment is helping New Yorkers live a better life in New York, helping to address this housing crisis, to lower people's electricity bills, to get ICE out of New York, and stop making a bunch of Wall Street bankers millionaires who are literally not even doing their job. That is the bar we need to set, and we can on Tuesday if people vote for Drew Warshaw for New York State Comptroller.
So when voters come to the poll and Democratic voters come to the poll, why should voters choose you over your other opponents?
Sure. Well, I think I've hopefully made the contrast very clear with Mr. DiNapoli. But as far as my other opponent, look, you know, we know what he has done with political power. We know because he was in the Kansas State Legislature. He was a politician and he had power. And when he was there, by his own admission, he voted with Kansas Republicans 80% of the time when he was in the Kansas State Legislature. It's literally in a campaign advertisement of his own that he used when he ran and lost for Congress in Kansas. He voted against abortion access. He voted against gun control. He has an A rating from the NRA. He voted to make English the official language of Kansas. So we know what he has done with political power. And as a lifelong New Yorker, fighting for immigrant rights, fighting for campaign finance reform, helping to rebuild the World Trade Center after 9/11, taking on these utility monopolies, and running the largest affordable housing nonprofit organization, that is my record. So for my part, it is what I have spent my life doing, and the very concrete and specific plans and the vision that I have for using that power and using that money for those working New Yorkers without it.
That was Drew Warshaw, Democratic candidate for the New York State Comptroller's Office. Primary day in New York is Tuesday, June 23rd. Radio Casco is continuing its candidate interview series to help voters hear directly from the people running for office. So, Drew, thank you so much for doing this. I do really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks so much for caring. And would be grateful to have your listeners vote. Thank you.
And Radio Catskills reached out to incumbent controller Tom DiNapoli for an interview, but we have not heard back. We did hear back from his other challenger, though, Raj Goyal, and we'll speak to him tonight on the Local Edition. Still to come, when many people think of LGBTQ history, they may think of large cities, but one important chapter was written on a rural hillside in upstate New York. After the break, we'll talk about Lavender Hill, a groundbreaking LGBTQ commune. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Frank Sinatra's in South America. There's music from the Dawn of Tiki. And the Waitiki Seven play the national anthem of exotica music. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As Pride Month continues, much of the conversation around LGBTQ history focuses on urban centers like New York City and landmark events like the Stonewall Uprising. But another chapter of that history unfolded in rural New York. In the early 1970s, a group of activists and visionaries established Lavender Hill, an LGBTQ communal living experiment with roots in the Catskills that challenged traditional ideas about gender, family, and community. The site was added to the State and National Register of Historic Places last year. And joining us now is Jeff Iovannone, a Historic Preservation Program Analyst with New York State Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, whose research helped document the story of Lavender Hill and its place in New York's LGBTQ history. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Most people, as I said, may think of LGBTQ history with places like New York City and Stonewall. What drew you to the story of Lavender Hill, and why is it important to broaden this historical LGBTQ narrative?
Yeah, well, I thought it was fascinating that here we have a group of gay, lesbian, bisexual people who actually start off in New York City and are experimenting with communal living in the Catskills and in Staten Island, and ultimately decide that they want to leave New York, and they purchase land in rural upstate New York, which is the reverse of the story that we typically get about LGBT. It's you're going from a small town.
We're getting a few dropouts on your line there, Jeff. Just want to let listeners know that it's not their radio. It might be this line we have with you, but you were talking about the reverse. People in rural areas who may be LGBTQ tend to go to larger cities, but these are folks coming from the city to upstate New York. Can you talk a little bit more about Lavender Hill's emergence from the gay liberation movement of the early 70s?
Sure. So when we think of that period, I think our mind typically goes to Stonewall or to all of the activism that generated, the first Pride marches. And the group that forms Lavender Hill in that. And one of the things that gay and lesbian people were experimenting with at the time was different types of living collectives and communal arrangements connected to the larger 1960s, 1970s counterculture and the Back to the Land movement. But for gay and lesbian people, these types of experiments really had an added layer of meaning where they were creating families of choice as opposed to biological families where they might not have been.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit of loss on the line again there. Let's move forward. Let's keep pushing forward, see if we can get it correct. Keep going there and get it a little stronger. We talk about the collective known as the 25 to 6 Baking and Trucking Society. That was the commune that had the roots back here, the Catskills. What does that history of that part of the group tell us about this experimental spirit of the era?
Yeah, so Lavender Hill is unique because far longer than other being communes of the period. Really around, probably for around. And I think that part of that is they were experimenting with different communal living situations in the Catskills and also Staten Island. And that allowed them to find a strong core group of people that really worked well together. And it's that core group that then comes from the city to rural Tompkins County in the Finger Lakes.
And one thing that stands out about Lavender Hill is that it was a mixed gender commune with a strong feminist influence. Talk about that compared with other LGBTQ communes or movements of the period.
Yeah, that's another extraordinary aspect of the history, that you had men and women living together, which was atypical, because gay men and lesbians were either exploring their identities independently, or if they were living together, conflicts could emerge. But one of the central figures in the early Lavender Hill days was Larry Mitchell, who was a professor at Richmond College in Staten Island, and his philosophy and approach to gay liberation had a very feminist orientation that the group also adopted. And for that reason, they were able to work well together as a mixed gender group. They were really into challenging gender norms and roles. So there wasn't, you know, necessarily a typical gender division of labor that we might see in other communal living experiments.
The commune also openly challenged traditional ideas about family and domestic life, and it lasted much longer than many other similar communes. What allowed it to survive when so many others maybe dissolved after just a few years?
Yeah, so I think you have the strong group. You have the philosophy that everyone is oriented around. And then also the property that they purchased in the Finger Lakes, they had 80 acres of land. So they had enough space where people could balance collectivity with privacy. So there was a main house. But then as time progresses, some of the more introverted members start creating their own little houses and structures. And then also people would move between the commune and New York City or the Bay Area. So it really allows them to last as a chosen family much longer than we see from other similar communities of the period.
And one of the other things that was unique, some of the members were contributors to the Moosewood Restaurant Collective.
Yes.
Which I think still exists today.
Yes, it does.
And so they definitely expanded their influence and their creativity beyond the property itself. You know, your job as a preservation historian, what kinds of sources helped you reconstruct this story? And were there any discoveries that surprised you during this research?
Yeah, great question. So the Lavender Hill group, they were primarily Italian-American and Jewish working-class artists and activists. And because they were all artistic, intensely creative, they did a really great job of documenting art through photographs, through writing, this communal experiment that they created. So the living members were incredibly generous and gave me access to a lot of their personal materials. In addition, Larry Mitchell's papers are archived at Cornell University as part of their human sexuality collection. And then oral history was also an essential part of the research process. I interviewed and talked with all of the surviving members multiple times as we were working on the National Register nomination together.
And it was added to... Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it was added to the National Register in early 2025. It's on the New York State Register of Historic Places as well.
Correct.
And, you know, as we mark Pride Month, what do you hope New Yorkers take away from this story and why it's important to preserve these historic sites, particularly in rural communities where this history is often overlooked?
I think this is a story that people especially need right now. This finding chosen family, finding where you belong, creating a vision that allows you to sustain yourself and other people. And even though the members of Lavender Hill aren't living communally any longer, so they don't fit the technical definition of a commune, I think Lavender Hill still exists as a vision of possibility, a utopian ideal that we should continue striving towards.
That's Jeff Iovannone, a historic preservation program analyst with the New York State Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, whose research helped document the story of Lavender Hill. You can read about the Lavender Hill Commune and LGBTQ liberation in upstate rural New York at the New York State Parks and Historic Sites blog, nystateparks.blog. Jeff, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
We'll come back with local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington next. This is Radio Chatskill.
We know kindness is a good thing. So when we think of doing something nice for someone, why do we so often hold back?
I'm not the first person to suggest that being kind to other people improves well-being, and yet we have tons of opportunities to be kind to other people that we don't take advantage of.
Breaking through the barriers to kindness, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Summer is here and we're ready to boogie at the Radio Catskill Dance Party happening Saturday under the stars at the Coshecton Pump House featuring Radio Catskill DJs. Jason Tuga of The Mixtape with dance classics from the 70s through the 90s and Jeff Barnes of Electric Mountain spinning techno, house, and indie beats. Come out and dance with Radio Catskill this Saturday, 7 to 10 at the Coshecton Pump House. $20 suggested donation at the door.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality. On Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill, and we're ready to boogie with James B. Huntington. Working 9 to 5. It's Monday, and we get local economics perspective from our own local economist and author, James B. Hello.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, today we learned of the death of Alan Greenspan at 100, former Fed chair, longtime Fed chair.
And he was a good one. He was a very good one.
And then last week, the newest Fed chair came out and announced what the Fed was going to do with interest rates. So what happened with those rates last week?
They stayed unchanged. That was not unexpected. There was a remarkable lack of controversy. It was supported by all 12 members of the Federal Open Market Committee to keep everything the same. They said it was the first policy vote since June of last year, that's a year ago, that did not feature some form of opposition. So it's staying the same. 8 of the 12 said that they thought reasonably rates could remain unchanged by year end for the rest of the year. One person thought that there would be a quarter point cut sometime. That's all speculation because the decisions they make will be based on the data they have at the time, and we don't have that data yet. But yes, a few other things that what they were thinking, they raised their forecast for inflation. They're expecting it to be 3.6%, even 3.3% if you take out food and energy. So we forecast the economy growing at 2.2%, which is good if unspectacular for the rest of the year, and unemployment staying about the same at the 4.3%. It's at now.
And,
so yeah. That's where we are. Remarkably peaceful times for the Fed right now.
Well, and Kevin Warsh, the new Fed, was generally got good reviews, it seemed, with you know, the way he handled things. Is that your take on it?
Yes. Well, he went with the clear solution, did not make a fuss, did not turn out to act like Trump was acting for a while, saying lower rates, lower rates, lower rates. He went through and then soberly did what was clear. We don't know anything really about the next one, which I believe is August. So it could wind up going up or down or staying the same. But so far, he hasn't done anything wrong.
A lot of task forces announced during his conference, their news conference there. Of course, the U.S. war with Iran has triggered that sharp jump in gasoline prices now with this tentative ceasefire agreement, which is, I believe, still being hammered out as we speak. You know, folks may expect gas prices to go down, but why might they stay high even if this does come to a conclusion?
Well, the oil price right now is in the 70s per barrel, which is down from last week. We don't think that it's going to get much lower, though, for reasons. Are two major reasons. One is the amount of oil-related infrastructure in the Middle East that's been damaged or destroyed. Some of it's going to take years to put that back together. Second, we still don't know about whether going through the Strait of Hormuz is safe, and companies with tankers and such may wind up being more cautious on that.
And so, with this jump in gas prices, folks are you know, looking at electric vehicles, and some folks who already have electric vehicles might be saving money. How much are they saving with gas prices still high?
Well, we have a survey here. It disturbs me that they did not try to take the entire cost of driving, but just the fuel. From the fuel end, it's just, as of January, it was an average, it was almost half of what for electricity than the gas-powered cars would be. It was $5.77 for electricity and $11.23 for gas. The latest reflects $5.89 for electricity for 100 miles and $16.69 for gas. One thing is a couple of reservations here. One, this is really based on home charging, which is a lot slower than other things. That can be more than double if you use a fast charging thing. In fact, almost three times. Second of all, we don't have any consideration here of other costs of driving, and they can be different. Some, in some ways, maintaining electric vehicles can be higher. So we don't have. So it really is going to depend on what kind of car you have, and what are your driving habits, and so on. But it is clear, it certainly is clear right now, that electricity has gone up very little and gas has gone up a lot. So it is favorable for electric vehicles.
It also could be where you live, what state you live in, there's different prices in different states.
Yes.
Well. Let's talk about retirement now. How much money does one study say you now need for a comfortable, quote-unquote, comfortable retirement?
This number, which contains regions all over the United States and innumerable personal preferences, is $1.46 million.
Wow.
So that seems like a lot. Most people do not have that much money when they retire, but that is a mid-range what people need to retire comfortably, that much in savings. So it's just an approximation. It a lot of it will depend on what you want personally, what your situation is, how much you'll need is going to vary a lot with your lifestyle and lots of regional differences. So there are areas that are expensive and less expensive, but you can take that as a very vague approximation. So if you have only $400,000, you're probably not ready. And if you have $2.5 million, you certainly are ready. But anywhere between those two approximate numbers, it's going to be dependent on a lot of other factors. Yeah. So this gives you an idea. They plugged in the data they had, and the number they cranked out was $1.46 million. So that's one possibility.
And also in retirement data news, there's a new study showing that some of the folks saving for 401ks might be shortchanging themselves. How's that?
Yes, well, this was a stunning statistic. I did not even know about this, but a lot of 401k savers, in fact, 61% of people with 401ks, this is amazing, they had their money in what's called the target date fund. And that is something where the investment company gives you and what they expect will be a certain amount of money by a retirement date you name. So it will change assets. It will make things more conservative if you're quite close to that date, or it could be more aggressive if you're running short and there are only months or maybe a year or two or something to go. But it's doubtful whether these are really the best things. And it's often, and this has been a conventional wisdom for a long time in the investment area, that people who are older tend to be too conservative as far as their investment choices. Mm-hmm. So much of the money is not all the time, but so much more money is designed for things that are riskier, that comes back from things that are riskier, and this is really an example about that. So you just don't get as much growth. So you can choose, but whether you should be sitting in, having your money sitting in one of these is really doubtful. You could sort of invent your own in a way by looking at it and making changes, which you can make with 401ks, and determining what you think instead of slamming on the brakes for the last 6 months or a year or 2 years. It's really better off to pick things that have more upside potential.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's talk about upsides and downsides with the numbers. What were the stock, oil, and other prices early this morning, and how did they change?
Okay, early this morning, we have gold $42.06 per ounce. That's down $122 over the past week. I think the world seems safer with the war in Iran ending or winding down or whatever it seems to be, and that's bad for gold. Silver did even worse proportionally, $66.27 the ounce, down $4. The ratio between gold and silver is now 63.5 to 1. Silver is looking quite weak, but it could hang out in the 60s for a while here if nothing really changes. People may be buying gold if they're looking to buy one of the precious metals instead of silver. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 51,565, up 363. Good, much like last week. It's not far from record highs here. NASDAQ did even better, 26,518 plus 629. It's still lower, though, than it was 3 weeks ago. It took some real hits earlier this month and late in May and it has not completely recovered. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $77. The barrel, which is down $3.61, a real result of what's going on with the war. They are still believing that it's going to cut down, even though there are still plenty of concerns remaining. Bitcoin, 64,070, down 1,600. It's just not looking good at all. British pound, 1.3221, down 2 cents, dropping, and we have another prime minister, their sixth this decade, resigning, and that is certainly going to cut confidence in the British currency, at least to some extent. Euro, 1.1456, quite similar, down a dollar, 1.46 cents. It's weak and unimpressive. Japanese 100 yen has spent another week at 62 cents. So overall, we really could go to in any direction this week. Stocks have been going up every week. Metals have been generally hurting. This will be, yes, this week will wrap up the first half. So it's a good thing to think about.
All right.
When I read these numbers next week.
All right, James B., we'll talk to you next Monday. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
Now, Grammy-winning rock icon Melissa Etheridge is hitting the road this summer with country music superstar Winona Judd for the Raised on Radio tour. The tour is making a stop at Bethel Woods on Sunday. And in advance of that, she spoke with our own Jason Dole about the tour, the enduring power of radio, and playing at the historic site of Woodstock.
Well, Melissa Etheridge, thank you for joining us on Radio Catskill.
My pleasure. It's good to be back.
Yeah, you're Sunday night. You're coming back to the Catskills, playing Bethel Woods with Winona Judd on your Raised on Radio tour. What can folks expect?
Oh, they can expect to have a good time and hear the songs that they heard on the radio back, you know, maybe a couple decades ago. Because Winona and I, we love playing live, but we love playing our hits for everybody that was there in the 90s and those that have found the music since, and then bring in a couple new songs. And so we're ready to just shake it up.
Yeah, you're calling it Raised on Radio Tour. Do you consider yourself raised on radio?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Radio was a big, big part of my life, my childhood, my adulthood. It was where I wanted to be. It's where I heard all my favorite artists. It's where I learned about music, about the music I love. No, radio still is very close to my heart. I love it.
Well, that's good to hear, but I'm biased because I'm in this profession. But I will say, radio is also where I encountered you for the first time, you know, as a kid, yeah. Hearing you know, coming out on the radio, because back then that was how you heard new music. You must love playing live, because, I mean, this tour, Raised on Radio, is going to take you into the fall, and it's coming hot on the heels of your spring tour. That just finished up last month. that was the Rise tour. It's in support of your new album, Rise. And I'd like to talk about that, if we could, because Rise is produced by Shooter Jennings, featured a collaboration with Chris Stapleton, released on Sun Records. Can you talk about how you brought a bit more country into this album while still keeping things rocking?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I feel that country music had always been sort of a place that I revolved around, and I enjoyed. I mean, I grew up with country music, and the first bands I played in were country. And then I really leaned into the rock and roll side. I felt that was where I was more comfortable. But now it seems like country music kind of, the music I hear on country stations are kind of what I heard in the 90s, like the pop stations. And so I feel like we've kind of moved closer together. I feel like people aren't judging me on maybe my own personal human choices, but they're taking the music and loving it. And that means a lot. And I love, I think country music is still, loved live. People love to go hear live music. And I love kind of hanging out in those circles. And me, I just love performing live. That's just what I've done. It's what I do and what I love to do.
if folks haven't been paying attention, if anybody listening right now, you know, didn't hear anything from Rise yet, I would just like to play 10 seconds from your lead single, if you don't mind.
Oh, please. Thank you.
Don't you want a woman who can rock yourself?
Oh, man. That's an opening. That is powerful and soulful and country. It's all that right there. I mean, my goodness. It's a good thing you're playing a pavilion, because you could blow the doors off the place with a voice like that. My goodness.
Well, that's the way we start the show, so don't miss the first note.
Okay. Spoiler alert. I just gave that away. Yep. You know, so I heard that song is like a rallying song for the Kansas City Current. That's a women's soccer team that you're a big fan of. How did that connection happen?
Oh, I'm from, you know, Leavenworth, Kansas, which is Kansas City, basically. And boy, when the team came to Kansas City and the owners built the first stadium dedicated to women's sport, I just said I got to get behind this. And man, do they have a team. They have some of the best players, and there's a generational Messi type of player, and her name is Timwa Shewinga. And actually, she there's a picture of her meeting. I mean, she's with Patrick Mahomes and Lionel Messi and Timwa Shewinga, and I tell you, they are on the same level, and it's very exciting. If you haven't caught women's soccer, get behind it, because it's exciting. It's very exciting.
I mean, women's soccer has been getting more recognition in recent years in America. Soccer in general is having another moment with, you know, mm-hmm. the World Cup. But mm-hmm. in doing some research for this interview, I found out that, like, there's a connection to women's soccer, like, in your musical history, that people coming out to see your show, you know, started with some friends that were on soccer teams. Is that right?
My manager's. Oh, right. I looked at my wife going, what's he talking about? Oh, you're talking about, that's the way I got signed. Yes. When I was playing in Pasadena, the girls that played on the college team there, the Cal Tech team, they would come in on Sundays, and one of their coaches, her husband was a manager. And so they kept saying, you got to come hear this girl. And he finally did. And that became my first manager. So, yeah, one of my first breaks came from soccer. Yes. Trivia, yes.
It's trivia. I'm sorry to throw some trivia at you, but I just love when things come full circle like that, because here you are, like, all these
absolutely.
Decades later.
I forget that. I need to remember that.
Speaking of history, this is, I think it'll be your third performance at Bethel Woods. I could also be wrong about that, but you know, there's a lot of musical history at that site. It's where the famous Woodstock Music and Arts Fair happened back in 1969. I'm wondering, is that something that you're aware of when you're there? And does the musical history of some of the places that you play at, you know, does that impact your performance in any way?
Absolutely. I have a deep belief that stuff stays around, especially the Woodstock connection. And every time we come there, yes, this is my third time there. And every time I go there, some of us go out and they take us for a ride out and see the whole exhibits and everything that are there, and the history, and that music can and did and does change society, changes the world. And I love being part of that. And that's real. It's really a historic place. And I always pay tribute to that when I'm there.
Great. So that's one more thing for people to watch out for when you're there, when they're there at the show. So, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And before we go, I'm wondering, is there a song from Rise that you'd like us to go out on?
Oh, my. Oh, gosh. Okay, pick one song. Let's see. Do we want a rockin' song, or do we want to feel? What do we want? We want, you know what? Play Being Alive, because
okay.
Being Alive is the first track, and it is just exactly what it says. I love being alive. This is my time. I know things go up and down in life. You feel the joys, and you feel the pains, and you feel the excitement, and there's just no better place than this life. And that's what being alive is all about.
All right, perfect. Melissa Etheridge, thanks again. Is there anything that we didn't get to that you wanted to make sure we say?
No, it was fantastic. I really appreciate it. It's a fun interview. Thank you.
And that's Jason Dole speaking to Melissa Etheridge. And she'll be with Winona Judd Sunday at Bethel Woods. We should note Bethel Woods is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. That's going to do it for us. It's WJFF Jeffersonville.